Moncrief on News Talk
with the Dacia Duster. Shockingly affordable, and now with 3 months deferred payments too.
10 years ago, Sinead Berg began her career as a style blogger. Now, she lurches towards the grand old age of 30. Her CV includes the terms academic, influencer, activist, broadcaster, and now writer. Her first book, a book for kids, is called Break the Mold, How to Take Your Place in the World, and she joins us now on News Talk. Afternoon, Sinead.
Afternoon, how are you?
Not too bad. How's your pandemic been?
Interesting and different. Before this, travelled quite a bit. And I have been home here in Ireland in my family home since the beginning of March. And I think, like most people, life and work looks different. I spent my time learning how to knit hats, one of which I can give to you should you wish on. And they're beanie hats. They're relatively okay looking. Yeah. You could make them work. And I've been walking and hiking every morning. And one of the things that I did with time was write this book, Break the Mold. But I think the pandemic has taken an effect on all of us, our mental health, our understanding and control of reality. But it's been challenging, but optimistic.
Had you planned to write this book anyway, or did you suddenly find yourself, I'm stuck at home, I know what I'll do?
No, there was no plan to write the book. I came home just before the Taoiseach's announcement, just before St. Patrick's Day, and had quite a bit of work put on hold, and thought, now that I have time, maybe I should see if, like everybody else, I have a story in me. And reflecting on my experiences of being a teacher and being a disabled woman, you know, when I was in school myself in primary school, all I wanted was to go to the classroom library to pick up a book and for the cover to look like me, for the stories inside to look like me, so that I could translate that conversation to the people I went to school with. And then when I was a teacher, I remember I was teaching in fifth class girls in Ballymun. And I taught this story called Charlie's Dream, where the illustrations were rooted in Ballymun of the flats and the various different characters who you might meet there. And the conversation that started in my classroom, I remember one of the girls looking at the illustration and saying, I know him. He's my friend's dad. And the power of stories to make people feel seen and heard. So I thought, maybe it could work. Maybe it won't. We'll see what happens.
Did that ever happen to you when you were growing up, that you saw something on the TV or a book or anything, we said, ah, that's me?
Not really. And particularly as a woman or as a young girl, the representation was just not there. Now we have brilliant Paralympic athletes. We have Ali Stroker in Broadway in the US, who's a wheelchair user. But I think still we don't hear or see disabled voices, be they visible or invisible, within popular culture and within culture at large. And I think that affects so many people in realizing what their potential is, because it's that phrase, isn't it? If you can't see it, you can't be it.
At the same time, though, let's talk a little bit about the book and the structure of the book and how that works.
So the book is using my experience as a little person and the lens that I have on the world, but using as it a case study to explore broad themes for children. And a couple of the key messages are encouraging children to realise that they are enough just as they are, that we shouldn't be trying to change people in order to fit in, that we should be changing the world so that it is designed for everyone. And it is, there's activities and questions and lists that they kind of build. It's encouraging children to be allies, to be in the playground. And if somebody in their friend group points at somebody and says, he's gay, what do you as a 10-year-old say in that instance? Do you have the bravery to say, that's not cool? Or does your silence give other people permission? So it's trying to leverage my experience of being a teacher to encourage people to believe that, well, anything is possible, and we all have the tools within us to make the world a safer place for people to just be themselves.
For a 10-year-old, though, to say that's not a cool thing to say, that is, you're a teacher, you know that how poisonous places playgrounds can be.
All the more important that we give them that language, because I think there are so many children who would love to step outside of their comfort zone and say something but don't have the words. And by giving them a script and, you know, taking out gay for perhaps a different identity, we can all participate in those conversations. They're not too adult. We just need to explain them in a way that is rooted in the child's lived experience.
I was interested to read in an interview you gave that you said you've always been used to being the centre of attention. But and to a degree, has the last 10 years been a process for you of saying, OK, I don't mind being the centre of attention, but I want to be the centre of attention for different reasons?
I think that's always been my experience. You know, I stand at the height of 3'5" tall. And for as long as I can remember, people have stared, sometimes laughed, pointed, called me names, taken photographs and videos of me without my consent, just because of my disability. And I think in many ways my work in fashion was rooted in that experience because people made assumptions over who I was and what I could do based on what I looked like. Whereas if I sit across from you in a wine dress and heels, you have a sense of who I am. Don't tell me what that is, but you do. It gives me agency over my own aesthetic. And yet it wasn't an industry that I could access because they just didn't think of me. So I think the work that I do both in education and in fashion and attempt to do is rooted in having agency, not just for myself, but ensuring that dignity and agency are resources that we give to people to be who they are.
Where did you get your agency from? Or was there a process or was there a person where you thought, oh, hang on, I can do whatever I want to do?
My parents. Mm-hmm. My dad is a little person like me and my mom is average height like you. And from the earliest of ages, they created this unified front where they always told me I could do anything that I wanted to do. I might have a different route or methodology than my friends or my siblings, but it was all possible. They always encouraged me to dream big with this notion that even if I failed, I would learn something from the process, that the worst that could happen is that it didn't work out. I would find a different route, but to try anyway. And they were my advocates for me when I wasn't old enough to be an advocate for myself. But really importantly, they took that step back when it was time for me to use my voice. Now, they're still the people I turn to on the most challenging days. If somebody has made me feel upset or made me feel less, they are the people I call, even at 30. But they are the foundation that gave me permission to be myself.
So you never doubt it because they wouldn't let you doubt. Or, you know, do you remember a process of growing in confidence?
I think there are still moments, even now, where I'm nervous and unsure if I'm the right person to be having conversations or if I have all of the tools. I think it's human behavior. I think we all have this narration that's in our head that constantly tells us we're not good enough, that, you know, our competitors in the other stations maybe are better, not that they are, but that they could be. And I think that is something we need to condition differently within ourselves, be that children or be that adults, because we often wouldn't say the things to other people that we say to ourselves. And I think, you know, there's a section in the book where I talk about being 11 and having an option to have surgery to make me taller. And my parents, with such bravery, said to me, you need to make this decision yourself. We can't make it for you. And I'm not a parent. But I think it was so incredibly powerful of my parents to make that decision. And I remember sitting with it. My legs would have been deliberately fractured over the course of a year. They would have been stretched apart so that new bone grows. And I might have been 6 inches taller. The surgery was wrong for me, but it isn't wrong for others. It was my choice. And what made me say no to the surgery was realizing that the only reason I'd be undertaking it was to make other people more comfortable, to fit in, to look closer to what everybody else looks like. And I realized that if people, particularly at 11, if other girls only wanted to be my friend because I changed myself to fit in, they weren't the people I wanted to be friends with. I would find my own friends who accepted me as me. And that might be one person, that might be none. But I was good enough just as I was. And I think that set me up in terms of a mind frame when I became a teenager and adolescence. And there were still huge moments of challenge, but I think that created an ignition in self-confidence.
Wow, that's a hell of a decision for an 11-year-old to make.
I was really flippant about it at the time. I was like, oh, well,
11-year-olds
you know,
are.
If they don't like me, like, you know, that's their problem. And my mom and dad were like, great. And, you know, if you change your mind tomorrow, that's okay. You know, if you want to have the surgery tomorrow, that's okay. But I didn't. I just said, you know, I'll find my own friends. Thanks.
Was there like a time frame for that surgery where they said, you know, you can have it when you're 11, but you can't have it when you're 15 or something?
So the idea behind it was that it would just be ahead of your growth spurt. So that you would get the maximum amount of time in order to be as tall as possible. And it just, it wasn't for me, but it could be for others.
Right. And then you see, the thing is now, and like the texts that are coming in was, what was it like in the White House? What was it like in the Met Ball? Like you haven't just like, you've done well by any metric whatsoever. You're like part of the elite now. You're up there with George Soros and the Illuminati controlling the world.
Steady.
Yes. And it all seemed to happen, I suppose this is like from a distance, it all seemed to happen so quickly. Yeah. Did it seem to happen quickly to you?
No, but I think anybody who wants to create change wants the change to have happened or wants the change to happen right now. And I think what I understand is that any change that happens overnight is probably for marketing purposes rather than actually the people whose lives will be affected most. So what I'm trying to do is create systemic change in education and design where we create a new system almost. And I think that will take longer than I'd like to admit, but we'll keep pushing forward.
So you're aware to a certain extent when you're on, you know, the cover of Vogue that, you know, that's great PR, but it doesn't change anything for anybody.
I think it makes a difference to people who were younger like me. I think it makes a difference to a little person or a disabled person who is passing their local newsagents and for the first time sees a body like theirs represented and authenticated by an institution like Vogue. That matters. And visibility has such importance because now they know, well, Vogue has ticked off the list. So do they want to be a Michelin star chef? Great. Yeah. In terms of the industry, it's not the solution. It is a step towards a solution. But what does the boardroom look like? What does the design team look like? What does the university look like where the design graduates will come from? Because for me, it's about more than just the image. It has to be about the strategy, the action, the plan, the work. How do we develop a new process that is inclusive of all voices? Because that's the only way we'll be truly representative.
So prior to lockdown, and I think you came back from Australia or someplace, what was your job now prior to that? Because I did, you know, reel off a long list of things that you do. But in terms of traveling around the place, what is it you're doing?
So I set up a company called Tilting the Lens. And it is a consultancy company looking at accessibility and inclusion as a starting point for innovation and design, rather than a legal checklist at the end, like, great, do we have a ramp? Tick box. Mm. And often when we talk about spaces and places, take historic buildings, for example, often we can't make them accessible because we protect architecture before we protect people. We say the architecture is too important. We cannot amend it. So we cannot include a ramp or a lift. My argument is, why can't we make accessibility beautiful? Why can't we bring the best of design and experts with lived experience together and create a ramp? A ramp looks like that because it was designed like that. Mm. We can change it. And I'm trying to build in a new process, a framework called Designing for All, where we think about those who have traditionally existed on the verges of who we accommodate for. Look at what those needs might be and how do we embed them in the process that has benefit for everybody, because we're all getting older. You and I might leave the studio today and we might fall and end up momentarily on crutches. So the idea is that you're not designing a world for me.
Mm.
You're designing a world for the future.
Yeah. Amanda wants to know, what was it like inside the Met Gala? Is there a massive party bag waiting for you, and do people really look at the art and clothes, or is it just about food and drink?
So when you arrive, you are greeted by the hosts who, for the time I went, was Anna Wintour, the editor-in-chief of Vogue, Serena Williams, the tennis player.
Okay, Anna Wintour, immediate questions there.
Go ahead.
Wagon? Nice?
No, lovely.
Oh.
Very approachable. She's probably the reason I have a bob, but we won't dwell on that.
Okay.
Serena Williams, Lady Gaga, Alessandro Michele, who's the creative director of Gucci, and Harry Styles. And each one of them came down to my level to say hello. We then go in and you see the exhibition, which in my year was camp. And then there is a drinks reception where everybody who you have ever read about or seen a film or listened to music by is in one room. And it feels very intimidating to know intimate details about their life because you've read about it in a magazine. Mm. But what is really fascinating in a room like that is people's kindness. People who would come up to you and say, hi, I'm Kate. And you're like, yes, you're Kate Blanchett. I know who you are. I know lots about you that I shouldn't know, but I'm Sinead. It's lovely to meet you. And that is really powerful. And, you know, the Met Gala is one of those moments that's part of lots of people's vocabulary of culture. And to be a person who is invited to be the first little person who's there, I'd love to sit across from you and say it was a total breeze, but it was probably the most intimidating thing that I've ever done, because I know that I can only speak for myself, and even other little people, their experience of life is far different to mine. But on a global stage like that, it feels like the world is watching, and it feels like my actions could possibly impact on how other people think of people who look like me. And the nervousness that bubbled up with that was so intimidating. But I rang my dad and I was like, I think I need to get the next flight home. And my dad said, Sinead, it's a party in a museum. You'd be grand.
Yeah. He was right too.
Get over yourself.
Yeah. You mentioned something there that when you met the people coming in, that they got down to your level to say hello. Is that something you appreciate, or you know, do you have a feeling about things like that? Because I mean, imagine that, like, people who aren't little people don't know how to act in that situation when they meet a little person.
I think it's an individual choice. My advice would be to ask the question first before lowering yourself or staying standing. For me, I prefer to be at eye level with people. It's maybe in terms of symbolism of power or just equality in conversation. So often I will ask a person to sit and I'll stay standing so that we'll be at eye level. I have a couple of friends who come down to my level to talk to me, but it's also not a physical act that I demand the minute I walk in the room. It's about
kneel before Sinead.
Please, can't spread that rumour around, Sean. Right. Small town. But for me, it's what's most comfortable when it's possible. It's just that if somebody is talking to me, particularly in a busy place, if we're all outdoors now, socially distant, I can't hear if you are both far away and above me. Those are the things that I like, but it is really an individual choice. Some people prefer that you stay standing. Some people prefer that you come down. It's always best to ask.
I also wanted to ask you about Juniper, because again, this is one of these, oh, I never thought of that. People go in to try on clothes and, oh, my ass doesn't fit in it kind of thing. But disabled people have all sorts of difficulties. And I suppose it varies from person to person what those difficulties might be just with getting on a garment.
So Juniper is a marketplace and a content platform for and by disabled people. I've taken up a role there as editor at large and helping with the creation of brands. One of the things that's really interesting to me when we think about fashion and we think about disability and design is not just designing for disabled people, but designing products that are designing with disability in mind so that it has value for everyone. So Sean, I'm not sure if you've ever worn a dress in your life, but for those who are listening, I imagine there are so many people who at one stage in their lives have had to sleep in a dress. And that is because they could not get out of it because the zip is at the back and they could not reach it. That's how you know a dress was probably not designed by a woman, because it wasn't designed with functionality in mind. Mm. Why is there a zip? Why is it in the back? Why are we still creating dresses like that? The answer is probably because it's always been done that way and we haven't thought of anything new. So my interest in, like, let's take the zip out. Let's put magnets in, or Velcro. Let's make magnetic and Velcro fixtures beautiful. Let's put them at the side or at the front. And that creates an opportunity and a business opportunity that has such a wide market audience. It doesn't make sense to include the zip at the back.
Yeah, it's nuts really, isn't it? Or maybe is it more cost effective to put a zip at the back?
But it's only cost effective because we're now buying in bulk.
Yeah.
Because that's what we've always done. So I think it's finding new ways that add value to absolutely everybody. And there are solutions out there. We just need to make it available for the majority. As you said, like, we're living in a pandemic. Another example of designing for all is working from home. Disabled people since time immemorial have been asking for flexibility about working from home because so many offices are inaccessible. The rationale was that it was impossible. And we have learned through this pandemic, it's not. Until it's the desire of the majority. So what can we all do to ensure that the majority are invested in accessibility? Because even if we're being selfish, we're all going to get old.
Yeah.
We will all need access.
True for you. Sinead, lovely to meet you. And thanks very much for coming in to us today. Sinead Burke's new book is called Break the Mold, How to Take Your Place in the World. Sinead, thanks a million. You are listening to The Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break after that. Are we all narcissists?
Moncrief on News Talk.
With the Dacia range. Drive away today with no payments for the first 3 months.